You've heard the Magnificat again, that wonderful prayer in Mary's voice. Do you know where the word Magnificat comes from? It's that Latin tradition of naming every psalm according to the first word found in that psalm, in the Vulgate, Magnificat anima mea Dominum. My soul magnifies the Lord. But if you listen to it out of the context of Luke's story, it's not a mother's psalm especially. It's not even a woman's psalm. It sounds like many others, Psalm 107, Psalm 98, Psalm 147. They all use very similar terms. And so, like all of these psalms, the Magnificat presents a problem. It says, God has brought down the powerful from their thrones. And don't you want to say, when? When was that? When were the hungry filled with good things and the rich sent empty away? When God announced to Mary that she would bear the Son of God? Well, that's a good answer for her. Sounds good, Mary, but people now have problems now. The rich are not sent empty away. Not from medical care in this country, not from ruined banks, not from war profits, not from carbon conferences. Does it ever happen? It seems only the poor get more poor. God has exalted those of low degree when? All the Psalms share in a problem like this, and they share in an ancient pattern. You'll recognize it. People believed firmly that God directed all events, personally rewarding and punishing according to his favor or to his wrath. Everybody believed that. War and weather and fertility were just tools in the hands of God to work out his will on people. So whenever a war was won, whenever feast replaced famine, whenever a king was crowned, whenever a plague was passed, poets wrote songs, psalms, songs, to praise and to please God, to remind him to keep up this kind of good work. You've seen this. You've either seen siblings where one becomes very much disapproved by the parent, and the others, they start to coddle up to the parent and they show how much they approve of the parental regime while the one who's bad is sent to the room. It's really quite similar. But now for at least 200 years more, it has become more and more difficult to hold to the notion that God moves matters around on earth in order to satisfy or to punish his people. In 1755, a terrible earthquake destroyed the city of Lisbon in Portugal. And it delivered to all of the mind of Europe a huge shock. Kings and philosophers and religious struggled with utterly incompatible theories about God, what God was up to in this earthquake. Rousseau and Voltaire had a falling out. If you've read Candide, you know that the Lisbon earthquake features significantly therein. Immanuel Kant, writing, called it blasphemy to suppose that humans can see divine intention in natural phenomena. The modern human was waking up. Pat Robertson apparently never heard the alarm. This old worldview now seems overwhelmingly self-centered. How can one blind himself to the fact that the good that God is supposed to have brought about in one person's life often drags harm into the path of another? This God, so servile to the pleadings of eligible prayers, this God who manages a cosmic game of musical chairs to fill or foil our wishes, this God who must cause a driver to tarry a little longer at tea so that she, not me, might end up on the evening news. This God is absurd or despicable. You choose. There are no alternatives. A 6-year-old friend of mine in Buffalo, on hearing the Exodus story of God's murderous mayhem worked upon Egyptians, instantly expressed scorn for one so violent and partisan. A child can see it. The modern mind has waked. God's not like that. Now, Luke may have been dealing with an early version of this problem of God. Consider, the people of Israel, who were in some part Luke's audience, they had felt the boots of Roman oppression on their neck for 150 years in Luke's day. Persia, Greece, Persia, Babylon had held Israel down for hundreds of years more before that. Do you not suppose that many of them wearied of the old formulas of thanking God for his mighty deeds? What have you done for me lately, Mr. God? Do you not suppose that praising him for mighty deeds and apologizing for misdeeds got old? Why, if there were an election for gods, the God would surely say, "Are you better off than you were 400 years ago?" In Luke's day, above the emperor's image on every coin were the words Devi Filius, Caesar Augustus, Devi Filius, son of God. It was in their face all the time. They were sick of the Caesars, to be sure, but singing psalms of God's salvation surely seemed futile to many. The book of Job is testimony to the fact. God's not like that. And so comes the question for Luke, how to wake the people to a new possibility. It's every preacher's puzzle. How may these people who struggle and flinch under the burdens of their days feel the touch of the eternal to convert them from fear to light? In the spirit of Christ, I believe Luke put an old song in Mary's mouth. Yeah, so that people would listen anew. Luke put the song in Mary's mouth, I think. This people whose bones were crushed by state terror and economic oppression heard their ancient hope in a new way. God has shown strength with God's arm and lifted up the lowly because the crucified one is risen. But what did they believe in Luke's time that God would now do for them? You know this story. For several generations, the early church believed that Jesus would come on a cloud descending, return from heaven to destroy all the powers on earth that are evil and to rule in peace and justice with the blessed believers. In other words, they were revving up the engines of that old ordinary hope that God would indeed be like the God of old, able and willing to sweep down into history to wipe away the tears of the poor and the lives of the tyrant. But such a God, such a Jesus, failed to materialize. God is not like that. For centuries more, after they more or less gave up on this imminent hope of Jesus' return, for centuries more, and right down to our own day, Christians have removed their hope of God in the public sphere and shoved him over into the private sphere of personal salvation. It's not very biblical, but that's what people have wanted. They have supposed that God, through Jesus, supplies everlasting bliss in heaven for those who have faithfully endured this veil of tears. to others who have not faithfully endured hell. Many people seem to take solace in this sort of thing. And yet, I wonder if they don't note how utterly that kind of imagination misses the core spirit of this Bible from which we preach. Let justice roll down like thunder, claims Micah. Righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. These words and like do not aim at some fantastic future. They are for this world, this time. And yet, who can believe today that God manipulates banks or armies or presidents or markets or even my head cold? It is great, really great, to wake up from childish belief, to come to this awareness that God's not there. But where? God's not like that. But what? Throughout most of Christian history, a smallish part of our teachers and masters have walked what is called the via negativa. Some of you will have encountered that phrase. It's Latin. It could be translated the negative way, but that's not too helpful. I like to call it the path of not, which is not fully self-explaining, but we'll get into this. I myself became Christian by this way of negations, the via negativa. I didn't know the path had a name. I didn't really know that I was walking in something that masters had lit well. I did take it to be like the way of Jesus in some manner. The via negativa, first of all, is not negative in the ordinary sense. It's not a downer. It refers to this. That you mindfully distinguish what God is not as you notice what it is you have been leaning on and gently pull away. That is the action of virtually every kind of meditation, but it is an action that can be lived out in countless ways. To notice what God is not. God is not my nation, not my race, not my party, not my skills. God is not my religion, not what preachers say on television that I deplore, not what the preacher says on Henry Street that I might admire. God is not the lift in the music at my church. God is not the people who are kind there, nor those who disappoint. God is not my prayer, not the one arranging good conclusions, nor bad. God is not my ecstasy. God is not my fear to live without this person or with that one. God is not my sure sense that I am doing God's will. God is not my vision for peace. God is not my justice. Put your hands in the air and step away from these thoughts. God is not these thoughts. Such is the shape of the via negativa. If you take it slow, not as an argument, not as a proposition, you hear the word position in the word proposition? Not as a proposition to fight with and win. If you take it as your own experience of relinquishment into trust, the path of God's not, through numberless crucifixions, passes beyond every fear and beneath the last foundation that could collapse. There, As we read from Thomas Merton last week, there in the last little bit before destruction is a kernel of gold, which is the essence of you, and there is God protecting it. This is something terrific. There, I submit, is God's mighty arm in action, keeping the flame in which burns your light eternal beyond all loss and gain. Now, what has this kernel of gold, so inward and so precious, to do with social justice, with Mary's magnificent prayer? It's commonplace for people involved in trying to change this world to hold contemplatives at arm's length and think that they're just wasting the world's time with their self-interest. But these have misunderstood something. The contemplative tradition has used a little French phrase to speak of the infinite and eternal assurance within God's knot. They call it le point vierge, a literal translation, the virgin point. Here, if it lasts but 7 seconds of your life, if it lasts a little longer, here in le point vierge is freedom absolute. For this freedom does not have your shape to it, your past, your ego are not present there. Here, everything is grace. And therefore, from here, action is free. And this is where God's justice and my salvation touch. Not much of our life looks like this. Presence in le point vierge, the virgin point. Maybe not even any of it until your heart is awakened by a mystical hope like this. But from this point, this point vierge, we can hear the sound of our name being called. Paul, the apostle, calls it like this. Let this same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped. He emptied himself, taking the form of a slave. He humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Let this same mind be in you, says Paul. Pass through God's knot so that Mary's song of salvation might become new, not hers, yours, not fantasy, but fulfilled. What really can hold back streams of righteousness from flowing in a people who are prepared to put on the mind of Christ? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, cries Paul later in this letter to the Philippians. When you pass through God's knot, this is never a once-for-all kind of thing. It's a process of repeated relinquishments, repeated crucifixions to what one once thought necessary. Through this process, you enter the infinite possibility of freedom in action. Augustine said, love and do whatever you will. That's how free, when inside le point vierge. Though at first you abide there a minute, an hour, within the virgin point of God's knot, you are the flame of divine love and justice and righteousness. There, yes. How could it be otherwise? How could God's love be manifest in you or me when we are taken up with positions and certainties? How can our action not smell like us when we are full of ourselves? How could one still full of her own opinions, her own needs, accept the command of Jesus to love your enemy as yourself? How can one accept that God's rain falls on the just and the unjust equally, as Jesus says, unless he or she were seeking to stand within this virgin point, this kernel of gold? Only in God's knot can you see it. And then, like Arjuna at last hearing his Lord in the chariot, with bow bent and arrow at the ready, you must fight. Fight, Arjuna. Fight, O Christian. For in the mind of Christ crucified, you are God's knot. God's not this heedless American way of caring for the easy in health and wealth and ignoring the poor, ignoring the, how do we call it in our way, the pre-existing sick. God's not, you are not fearful to offer the Samaritan's hand to immigrant and to poor. God's not this tower of profit and finance and production which we all inhabit, this Babel which is ever climbing upward for no purpose other than ever to climb upward and upward, threatening everyone on the ground beneath where its destruction will happen. God's not for these wars waged from desperate fears and greeds this last decade. God's not like that. Last week, Bill Moyers interviewed the great historian Howard Zinn. Anybody see that? He showed some of the new theater piece that Zinn and others have mounted called The People Speak. I think we should buy this DVD here. The various readings from The People Speak tell of 3 centuries of resistance by Americans to our nation's violence and oppression. 1 reality rang down through all these tellings. When women and men have been willing to die, not necessarily dying, but willing to die, to live and to die for God's not, then, and it seems only then, have the powerful been thrown down from their thrones. Power concedes nothing, wrote Clausewitz 100 and some years ago. Only this power of God's not can meet that material power of domination. Only then have the plans of the proud been scattered and the hungry filled with good things. You know, viewed from the outside by one who's trying to calculate the cost-benefit ratio for making a sacrifice like that, this way, this via negativa, this point vierge looks harsh and crude, and who would go there? But viewed from within, from inside the infinitely invisible point of light, God's kingdom is come. The future becomes present. Possibilities arise. God's will is done on earth. God has come down. God's not in heaven, but here, waiting in you, waiting for you, brother and sister, to put on the mind of Christ. When the faithful interposed their fearless will to die to whatever they knew in order to become the living flame of God's not, God has indeed brought down the powerful from their thrones and sent the rich empty away. This is done according to the promise God made to Abraham and to Sarah and to descendants of faith for